Welcome back to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. Author Jen McGinnis will be moments away, but first, do you have ants? Not in your garden. We're talking in your house, in your basement, in your bathroom like we do. Well, if you do, Rescue has the product to get them out of your home.
Yeah, Rescue Ant Baits. Ant colonies become noticeable around the house starting in spring. They seek food and moisture sources to feed their colonies, and once they establish that source, they lay pheromone trails for other ants to follow. So you can use the Rescue Ant Bait Stations, and then ants will transport the bait back to the colony, killing the ants at the source. The ants look for sugars to feed their workers and proteins to feed the queen and larvae. So Rescue Ant Baits use both protein and sugar for a faster and more complete colony kill. Unlike other ant baits that leak and spoil bait on your floor, Rescue Ant Baits are spill-proof and mess-free. They're child-resistant and safe to use around the home. Better bait, no mess, and child-resistant. Rescue Ant Baits have it all. Like all Rescue products, their ant baits are made in the USA. Go to rescue.com for where to buy. That's rescue.com for where to buy.
Holly, let's go to the hotline and bring in our guest for this week.
Jennifer McGinnis, a.k.a. Frau Zinni, is a blogger, photographer, writer, and author who enjoys gardening of all kinds. Her new book, Micro Food Gardening, will be available April 13th. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Well, thank you for taking time out of your day, not only to join Holly and myself, but enlighten all of us and our listeners across the country with your knowledge.
Thanks, I'll do my best.
So let's start with, what is microfood gardening?
Sure. Well, great question. Microfood gardening focuses on plants to stay very compact. So you'll be able to grow edibles even if you only have a front porch, window box, or windowsill. It's fun to select petite varieties of plants to grow and choosing container options to grow them in. So generally speaking, it's any edible plant that is approximately 18 inches or 46 centimeters or smaller when the plant has reached harvest size. Some plants, such as vines, might grow a little larger, but they still produce mini-sized fruits. And another bonus is that these dwarf plants often reach harvest size faster.
So we're talking about specifically created by nature or by a laboratory size plants, not necessarily a full-grown plant that you're able to control into a smaller size?
It could be both, because you can grow like the salad greens and keep them small as baby greens, you know, and not let them actually advance to a larger size of like a head of lettuce. But there's also, like you mentioned, there's a lot of plant breeders who have made different varieties for the home gardener that are going to stay dwarf and small.
Great. Now, your new book, Microfood Gardening, comes out soon, April 13th. Can you tell us about an interesting part of it, something to intrigue our listeners?
Sure. Well, it's a project-based book that includes 30 do-it-yourself planter ideas to grow micro-edibles in, along with growing tips for success. And I had a lot of fun coming up with the different projects that feature micro-edibles, especially the ones that repurpose a container in some way to make it into a gardening container. One of the ones I really enjoyed making was this project called the Strawberry Cake Stand, which repurposes cake pans that you would normally, you know, bake a cake in. But instead, you add drainage to them and you're able to grow alpine strawberry plants in them. And then you arrange them using a metal rod so that they look like a stacked wedding cake would. But, you know, there's no frosting involved. But it makes a nice table centerpiece, and it grows in a very compact space. And you get those delicious little alpine strawberries as a result.
Well, the neat thing about your book is in each project, you say, there's a little box that says what you'll need. And you not only describe what it is in metric, but also in standard measurement, so there's no confusion for anybody who may be able to do these projects in their home.
Yeah, I try to make it as approachable for everyone. And, you know, a few years ago, I didn't feel comfortable even using a drill, like a power drill, to around the house. And I've just become a little bit more comfortable with it all. And I realize like how many things can be repurposed and used for planting containers. And now I feel like, you know, I see something, if it doesn't have a drainage hole, I'm like, let's put it in there.
That's funny. So we've been putting up more bird feeders around the outside of our home. You like to attract songbirds. What are some tips to attract them to your garden or your yard?
So I really like to feed the birds in the winter. I really enjoy watching them, but to keep them in the garden all year long, I try to plant some native plants that are also going to provide them food on the other part of the season. And that would be plants that, you know, attract insects, which I think a lot of people think, oh no, I don't want those in my garden, but they're good because they will feed the baby birds. I think it's something like 6,000 or 9,000 caterpillars to raise a clutch of chickadees, according to Doug Tallamy. He's the expert on all of that. But if you don't use pesticides and you plant these plants that will attract the insects, produce seeds and berries in the fall, you'll encourage a habitat where they will be more likely to nest in your garden and stick around.
Fantastic. So we are talking with Jennifer McGinnis, a.k.a. Frau Zinni, a blogger, photographer, writer, author, and a new book coming out, Microfood Gardening. So you don't have a lot of full sun in your yard. What do you like to grow minimal light? And how do you best utilize your areas with full sun? It sounds like you're quite creative with the space you have.
I try to be. So for minimal light, I really defer to leafy green crops. They tend to work really well for part sun, part shade, especially in the summer heat. You can, you know, grow those in the shadow of something taller in your garden. And as I mentioned earlier, the baby greens such as lettuce and kale, they can be grown in spots with a bit more shade, and, you know, they can be used a lot of the projects in the book. And the nice thing about them is that they reach harvest size quickly. Like, it's about 20, 25 days and you can start harvesting those baby greens. So you can grow multiple versions of them in different containers. So that way you have more to choose from. So you're not just wiping out your crop when you're trying to do a salad for 1 week, you know?
Right.
And then for my full sun areas, they're actually in and along my driveway. So I had to get really creative about growing edibles in containers and grow bags. And a lot of, like, a good portion of my driveway becomes my container garden in late spring through late fall. So, you know, luckily our driveway's long enough to fit like three cars. And I would say at least one full car is like car length is just containers. and I use that space to grow a variety of edibles, especially tomatoes in that spot.
Well, gardeners are much like farmers. If there's a challenge, they're going to figure out how to make the project work. And you were able to do that with the figuring out the balance between where the good light was and where the minimum light was, and was able to maximize the potential that both of them provided you.
It's really about seeing what you have to work with and evaluating that space and figuring out what would meet those needs.
And we always encourage new gardeners or wannabe gardeners or people who think they can't garden, whether you have a balcony, if you have a windowsill, you can garden something. And
exactly.
Yeah. And it works very well. And you've got some projects in which can be done to grow herbs in mason jars, basically in your window. If you've got a good sunny spot, it will work very well.
Yeah, definitely. There's one project, the omelet combo, which definitely uses the mason jars, and you can keep that even on a well-lit countertop. And then you would have that at the ready. So when you are ready to make your, you know, breakfast omelets, you'll be able to go over and take off some herbs or some baby greens and add them right to your meal.
And not have to pay $6 for a frig of basil from the grocery store. And you got it right there that you've grown yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
So you raise monarch butterflies and even visit where they overwinter. We'd love to hear more about you raising them. And is this a huge project? Is this something that many people can do? What can you share with us?
Sure. So it's definitely fun. It's definitely fulfilling, but it is a lot of work if you take a lot of them in. So in my area, I'm in the Northeast in Connecticut. And for like around late August, early September is when we have the super generation of monarchs start to become caterpillars. And those are the ones that they believe, due to temperature cues and the shortened daylight, are the ones that can fly to Mexico and live for up to 8 months instead of their parents and grandparents that only live for a few weeks after they lay eggs. So at that time, I really start, you know, looking for them on the milkweed. I, as I said before, I don't use pesticides, so that's key as well. I bring them inside to protect them from predators because they can be, you know, attacked by wasps or sometimes birds. So I bring them inside. I keep them in containers and I clean those containers every day with fresh paper towels or fresh milkweed or both. The bigger they get, the more messier they get. So you just have to like stay on top of it. And then you know, you don't want them to be overcrowded either. So you want to make sure you either have like a really big butterfly, netted hamper container or different like little containers. Like, if you go to the pet store, you know, those little plastic ones, you can put, them in there, but you would need to space them out a bit more. So then, you know, I keep them in there, I keep them clean, and then they eventually turn into chrysalises, and then it's, you know, waiting for them to emerge. And that's the best part is when you bring them outside and you see them fly away. And it's so great for kids to see it too, for the first time, because I mean, it's magical as an adult, but when you're a child, it's even cooler, I think.
So you're looking at a couple of months project with this, correct?
Yeah, I really start to gear up in August, and then I would say they've pretty much all finished out by the end of September.
Okay, so it's not an overwinter; it's a short time frame. You're able to see the creation of the monarch, and then you let them go and go back into nature.
Right, and I actually do have other chrysalises that I'm overwintering in my garage right now. They're for the black swallowtail caterpillars. Mm. So they're out there right now, so they don't come out too early. They're, you know, with the colder temps, but they'll start to emerge probably like late April, early May, and then I'll release them as well.
That's amazing. Well, we've enjoyed our time with you. How can our listeners find out more about you?
Well, you can always find me over at my garden blog, which is frauzinni.com. And I'm on Instagram and Facebook as frauzinni as well. And I'm on Twitter as Jen M Gardens. That one came first, so you know.
Right.
Why ruin a good thing, right?
Well, Jen, we greatly appreciate you taking time for Holly, myself, and all of our listeners in order to enlighten us about micro gardening and what you can do with a little space and some creativity in your book.
Thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Absolutely. And
for more information, please visit thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.